Imagine walking into a dark, damp cave, holding nothing but a burlap sack full of rusty junkyard iron.
Right, not exactly standard adventuring gear.
No, exactly. But you step into a pool of water, you sink into the darkness, and well, when you finally step out on the other side, that rusty scrap metal has physically transformed,
Completely transformed.
yeah, into a perfectly balanced, gleaming 8-foot knight's lance. I mean, you haven't just stepped into another room, you've stepped into a world where the rules of childhood make-believe aren't just games anymore.
Right, they become the literal deadly physics of a parallel dimension.
It's wild. So welcome to today's deep dive. Our source text for this is a really fascinating chronicle that documents this exact phenomenon.
It is a profound shift in how we understand reality, honestly. The text tracks a group of modern kids from a totally mundane town called Ainnington, right?
Yeah, Ainnington.
And they cross over into this magical fey realm known as Mirari, and they think they're just playing a highly elaborate tabletop role-playing game.
Right, just pretending.
Exactly. But what they discover is that they are bound by the actual immutable laws of a parallel universe.
Okay, let's unpack this because we're looking at two entirely distinct worlds that overlap here. And I want you, the listener, to really think about your own childhood games for a second.
Oh, it's a good point.
Like, what if the rules you made up in your backyard were actually the physics of another universe? Because that's what we're dealing with. We have our core trio of characters.
Right, led by Agatha.
Yeah, Agatha, who is this wonderfully pragmatic teenager. She actually packs toilet paper, candy bars, and scrap iron for a magical quest.
Very practical.
Super practical. And then there's Alice, this innocent little girl clutching a stuffed unicorn, and Tom, an older teen who's playing the role of a lost explorer. So the mission of our deep dive today is to really examine the mechanics of this world. Like, how do the boundaries between human perception, imagination, and physical reality break down when play literally becomes survival?
Well, to understand the underlying logic of Mirari, we have to look at how they physically cross the threshold first. Because the transition itself establishes the baseline for how magic operates in this universe, they don't just close their eyes and wish themselves into a fantasy land.
No, it's way more structured than that.
Exactly. They are guided by a sorceress, Nimue, through a physical portal called the Siege of Stone and Water.
And the sensory details of that crossing are, they're just completely counterintuitive. They step into this dark cave pool in their mundane tan, but the water doesn't behave like water.
No, it feels completely dry.
Yeah, it feels dry. The fluid just glides around them, and instead of swimming, they just slowly sink while walking forward. The source compares it to riding a down escalator.
Right, they aren't stepping down, they're just descending while their feet stay flat.
Yeah, and then they plummet into this bottomless pit and shoot upward, finally breaking the surface into a polished, golden-lit stone chamber.
What's fascinating here is how highly structured that environment is. I mean, they aren't tumbling through chaotic fairy dust.
No, not at all.
The Siege of Stone and Water acts as a physical mechanical lock. And Nimue, their guide, she possesses the specific key. It's a very rigid system.
It honestly sounds a lot like putting on a virtual reality headset. You step into a designated zone, the software loads a new environment, and boom, the physics engine of the world around you completely changes.
Right, but there's a huge difference.
Well, yeah, in a VR game, if you take off the headset, you're safe in your living room. In Mirari, the physical stakes are life and death. Look at Agatha. She brings that sack of jagged scrap iron from a junkyard. She isn't treating this like a fairy tale.
No, she's treating it like a survival simulation. But let me push you on that VR analogy for a second.
Sure, go for it.
Because while the environment changes like a simulation, the biological reactions are deeply organic and rooted in actual chemistry. Agatha brings iron because in this realm, iron acts like boiling acid on fey creatures.
Right, it literally burns them. But I want to pause on that. Why iron?
Well,
I mean, in a lot of fantasy lore, iron hurts fairies, sure, but our sources treat Mirari as a place governed by belief. So why does the rusty pipe act like a weapon of mass destruction against these magical creatures?
think about what iron represents in the human world. It's the foundational element of industrialization.
Oh, right.
It is rigid, unyielding, magnetic. It represents the crystallized essence of human pragmatism. Mirari, on the other hand, is a realm of fluid, adaptable, belief-based magic.
They don't mix well.
Exactly. Introducing cold iron into Mirari is like dropping a highly reactive chemical into a volatile solution. It forces the fluid magic to violently crystallize, which physically burns the fey creatures.
Wow.
It is an ontological poison, Agatha's scrap metal is deadly because it enforces the rigid laws of the mundane world onto a world that totally resists rigidity.
That makes so much sense of a scene that happens right after they arrive. They walk out of this golden chamber past these massive guards who, by the way, have the heads and legs of stag
demons. The guards of House October, yeah.
Right. And Agatha just looks at these majestic creatures and quips, "Nice racks."
It's hilarious.
It is. But she is aggressively maintaining her mundane, pragmatic mindset. And she have to. Because the second they step outside, they are hit by this brutal, icy wind of a magical winter. Mirari is locked in a deep freeze.
And this is where we see the thermodynamic cost of magic. Nimue has to protect them from the cold. But she doesn't just wave a hand and banish the winter.
No, she drops to her knees, traces a geometric design in the ice, lights a physical, mundane candle, and speaks an incantation Lumineth and Prisasa to create a localized bubble of sunlight.
Right.
But, like, if she is this powerful ancient sorceress in her own realm, why does she need a cheap wax candle from the human world to cast a warming spell?
Because the magic in Mirari requires a thermodynamic anchor. The source material is showing us a system of energy exchange. She is channeling the conceptual warmth of the sun, but she needs a physical focal point of combustion, the candle to ground the spell in reality. Maintaining that bubble of summer in a magical winter is physically exhausting. It drains her biological energy. The magic isn't free.
It demands a toll.
Mm-hmm.
So they cross the frozen lake riding inside a dry bubble of air on a platform towed by an unseen leviathan, which is terrifying. And they arrive at Niwai's spire.
Which is an incredible visual.
Well, totally. It's a reversed spiraling tower pointing straight down into the bottom of the lake,
mm-hmm.
lit by this eerie underwater light. So we've established how the physical rules change when you cross over. But what happens to the people?
That's the real question.
Yeah, because inside that underwater spire, our sources introduce an object called the Opticon, which fundamentally shifts how we understand identity in this world.
The Opticon is essentially a magical camera that Agatha used back in the mundane world. But the photographs it develops don't capture physical photons bouncing off a subject.
Right.
They capture the underlying hidden reality that the mundane world obscures.
Here's where it gets really interesting. They look at a photo of their friend Simon, who stayed behind in the mundane world. And in the real world, Simon is just, you know, an awkward, normal teenager.
It's just a regular kid.
Yeah. But in the Opticon photo, overlapping his body, is this dominant, cat-eared, kobold-like shadow. The photo implies that Simon isn't just a kid playing a game with them. He is secretly a fey creature of House April.
It reveals his actual lineage. And furthermore, they examine photos of little Alice's old toy box, the stuffed animals and wooden figures.
Right, the Harcourt toys.
Exactly. The magical photograph reveals them to be full-sized, dormant, magical soldiers surrounding a bareheaded knight. There is even a captured inscription on the lithograph that reads, "We wait for the time of April's need and the word that shall be spoken."
That part is incredibly eerie to me. It suggests these aren't just toys Alice played with. They are a literal army waiting for her to wake them up, since she's supposedly the descendant of Princess Angelique.
Yes.
But the photo that really gave me pause was of a terrifying demon they encountered in the woods, the Scarecrow.
Oh, the Scarecrow, right.
In the front-facing photo, it's a horrific, giant monster. But the camera captured a second angle from the side. And from the side, you can see it is completely hollow from the back.
Right.
It's just a facade, a giant, scary mask with absolutely nothing inside.
Which tells us a great deal about the nature of threats in Mirari.
It's the perfect analogy for fear itself. When a fear confronts you head on, it feels massive, overwhelming, paralyzing. But if you can force yourself to step to the side to look behind the mask, you realize it lacks actual substance.
It only has power as long as you stare directly into the illusion.
Exactly.
Taking that a step further, the Opticon is showing us that Mirari is a dimension built on archetypes. The camera isn't predicting the future, it is revealing the mantles that exist in this world.
Mantles.
Yeah, a mantle is a pre-existing role. The knight, the princess, the trickster, the monster. The characters are not inventing these roles from scratch. The universe has these empty slots, and the camera reveals who is destined to step into them.
But wait, if the Opticon proves that Mirari forces your hidden, true self to the surface, that creates a massive vulnerability, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
I mean, humans naturally want to hide their insecurities and secrets. How do you survive in a world that aggressively exposes the truth of who you are?
You have to learn how to actively manipulate perception. And the sources transition to another location in Mirari Hawksmoor Keep, where Tom, the teenage explorer, is taking a lesson from Lady Raven in the art of glamour.
Right, and when I first read the word glamour, I assumed it meant shape-shifting, like growing a new face or turning into an animal.
A lot of people do.
But the text makes it very clear that glamour is not physical transformation at all.
Precisely. Glamour is the manipulation of internal intent projected outward. Lady Raven teaches Tom to focus his awareness on specific points of his body.
The wrists, forehead, heart, and center.
Yes. He has to gather an internal feeling, crystallize it into an intention, and project it into the space around him so that others perceive him differently.
She warns him that using glamour clumsily is like applying sloppy makeup. If you try too hard to hide something, the strain of the magic actually acts like a neon sign pointing directly at the deception.
It highlights the lie rather than hiding it.
Yeah, you have to be subtle. So Tom tries it. He gathers his focus around the concept of ordinariness. He just wants to be completely unnoticeable, and it works. Sir LeFallon walks right past him, actively looking for him, and completely fails to see him standing in the middle of the room.
He successfully bends the perception of the observer.
Let me challenge that for a second, though. Is this actually magic, or is this just weaponized psychology?
How do you mean?
Because think about the real world. Think about the concept of acting as if. If you walk into a high-stakes boardroom and you project absolute confidence, you take up space, you speak with a calm tone, people will perceive you as the authority in the room.
Sure.
You haven't physically shape-shifted into a CEO, but you have successfully altered their perception of reality. Isn't Tom just doing the fantasy equivalent of faking it till you make it?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that is a highly effective way to conceptualize it. But we need to look at the literal physics of a magical realm.
Okay.
In the mundane boardroom, you are relying on sociological cues to trick a human brain. In the Mirari universe, magic is a tangible medium. It is an atmospheric force. Consciousness and belief exert gravitational pull on that medium.
So he isn't just tricking the knight's brain.
No. When Tom strongly projects ordinariness, his localized belief is so dense that it physically bends the light and sound waves around his body. The magic weaponizes his psychology, turning a mental state into a literal cloaking device.
Oh, wow.
He doesn't just seem ordinary. The universe physically accommodates his intention to be ignored.
So if human belief can generate enough localized gravity to bend light and sound, who decided the foundational rules of this entire universe in the first place? Like, where did the broader laws of Mirari come from?
This raises an important question, and it's where the Chronicle delivers its most profound revelation. The sources pull back the curtain on the history of this game.
Yeah, this part blew my mind. We get a scene set back in the mundane town, Ainnicton. Tom sneaks up on his grandmother, Clarice Smith, while she's pruning apple trees. He whistles a specific melody, the song of a magical flute they found in Mirari.
And she recognizes it. She even hums along. His grandma casually reveals that she played this exact same game with her friends generations ago.
Including friends like Anastasia, who played Lady Angelique.
Right. And the historical context she drops completely shifts the paradigm of the entire source text. She talks about the original king of Mirari.
A boy named Ryan Jordan, who ruled for 1 year back in 1913, King Riordan.
Right. Ryan was a kid who moved to town, and the friend group elected him the king of their elaborate make-believe game. But after just 1 year, his family moved away abruptly.
With no forwarding address.
Yeah. The kids were heartbroken, but they had to explain his absence in the context of their game. So they simply made up a rule. In Mirari, a king only ever rules for 1 year. Let's examine the mechanics of what just happened there. Are these children just playing a game, or are they unknowingly reenacting or even forging a historical cycle bound by ancient magical laws?
It's crazy to think about.
Because that completely arbitrary rule invented by children as a coping mechanism for a friend moving away crystallized into a binding, undeniable law of the magical dimension.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around how that works. A child moves away in 1913, and the metaphysical physics of a parallel universe permanently change.
We have to view Mirari as a dimension of raw, responsive potential. It lacks its own internal structural integrity. It is like a blank canvas made of volatile energy.
Okay.
Therefore, it attaches to the most potent, organized source of imaginative structure it can find. And what is more potent and unwavering than the absolute dead serious belief of children engaged in deep play?
Nothing, really.
Exactly. The dimension requires narrative resolution to remain stable. When the king vanished, it created a structural vacuum. The collective belief of the children patched that plot hole, and the dimension adopted their explanation as a law of physics.
That is staggering. And it goes even deeper because Grandma Clarice says that when Ryan left the game, they imagined he walked down a set of hidden stairs beneath an angel statue, escorted by Lord Melchizedek, the Black Unicorn.
And he disappeared into history.
Yeah. And Tom immediately recognizes that narrative. It is the exact same backstory he was given for his own character in the present day. He is supposed to be the lost explorer who vanished with that exact same unicorn.
He realizes he is not playing an original character. He is stepping into a historical echo. The narratives established by the ancestors are dictating the reality of the descendants.
It's an incredible exploration of generational inheritance. If you abstract this out to our real modern lives,
yeah.
How many of the rules we follow every single day are just make-believe games invented by our ancestors?
Oh, absolutely.
The economy, paper money, national borders, corporate hierarchies, these aren't immutable laws of nature like gravity. They are arbitrary rules created by people who lived centuries ago to solve their immediate problems. And we just inherited them.
We forgot we were playing a game, and now we treat those rules as literal reality. We mistake the map for the territory.
Yeah, exactly.
Which
yeah.
brings all these disparate threads, the physical mechanics of magic, the exposure of hidden truths, the manipulation of perception, and the weight of generational inheritance crashing together in the final section of our text.
Morning in Mirari. The characters wake up inside the underwater spire, and they're forced to confront the fact that they can no longer be passive observers.
Right. Agatha and Alice wake up to a glowing will-o'-wisp acting as an alarm clock. But the crucial detail in this morning scene isn't the magical breakfast.
Even though Agatha does have imported Cokes, which is funny.
True, but the crucial detail is a massive mural painted on the wall of the spire.
Oh, the map. Yeah, the mural maps out the geography of their mundane town, Ainiton, but it perfectly overlaps with the magical realm of Mirari.
It's a one-to-one overlay.
Yeah. The mundane government circle sits exactly where the magical royal palace is. The town church overlaps with a majestic magical cathedral. It visually proves that the mundane and the magical are inextricable. They share the same soul.
And that shared soul demands manifestation. We talked earlier about Agatha carrying that burlap sack of junkyard iron across the portal, the scrap metal she brought simply because it was pragmatically useful.
Right, the ontological poison. She decides to unwrap the sack to check her weapons. And this is the ultimate proof that human belief rewrites physical mass in Mirari. It's not scrap metal anymore.
Not at all.
The rusty iron bar has physically transformed into Knight Redmayne's legendary 8-foot green and gold lance. The jagged metal tooth is now a perfectly balanced broadsword with a massive emerald in the pommel.
And it hums with energy.
It hums. And it feels perfectly right in her hands. And across the room, Alice, the little girl, finds a stunning white satin princess gown waiting for her.
Nimue tells Agatha a very revealing line here. She says, "You found these because they are yours. You sought them out. Uncovering their truth is your reward."
So what does this all mean?
The profound theme here is that you cannot remain a passive observer. The transformation of the weapons proves that stepping into a mantle, accepting the role of the knight or the princess, fundamentally overwrites your physical reality. You do not just play the knight. The universe physically equips you to be the knight.
So they don't have much time to ponder the philosophical implications because the climax hits with a sudden chime at the spire's door. And who is waiting outside?
Captain Morrigan.
Yes, an imposing, heavily armored Fey captain with literal antlers growing out of her forehead, backed by House October's troops. They are demanding an audience with the mortal.
It forces a point of no return. You cannot remain a tourist in Mirari.
Agatha can't just be the sarcastic teenager with a backpack anymore. She has an armed guard at the door demanding answers. She has no choice. She has to pick up the legendary broadsword. Alice has to put on the gown.
They have to act the parts they've been assigned.
The game is over. Because the game has become their actual life.
The overlapping map on the wall warned them. The mundane world and the magical world are locked together. They crossed the physical threshold. The opticon exposed their hidden destinies. They learned how perception shapes reality.
With glamour.
Right. And the historical cycle initiated by their grandparents has finally caught up to them. They must step up and inhabit the mantles they inherited.
It is a brilliant, layered look at how the narratives we inherit and the perceptions we project possess the power to forge our literal reality. And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want you, the listener, to pull these concepts out of the magical realm and apply them to your own life. We talked about the arbitrary rules of childhood games becoming laws of physics. We talked about adopting mantles built by our ancestors.
And I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. Think about a family tradition, a childhood game, or a deeply held personal narrative you have carried into adulthood. A story you tell yourself about who you are or what your role is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Are you consciously choosing to play that role? Or, like the children discovering the truth of Merari, has the game been playing you all along? What dormant soldiers in your own life are just waiting for you to speak the right word?
That is the perfect place to leave it. Thank you for joining us as we explore the incredible, dangerous world of Merari. We love uncovering the extraordinary mechanics hidden inside source texts like this, and we hope you enjoyed crossing the threshold with us today. Until next time.